aren't we? A little bit from chapter 1 into chapter 2. And really our theme for this morning is the creation of mankind, the creation of Adam and of Eve. Chapter 1 focuses on God's work in creating the whole universe, but chapter 2 really sees us, we have sinned through the language and the grammar and from another few other evidences that really the earth and particularly mankind is the centerpiece, isn't it, of all that God has created and made. So it's not that we have two creation accounts that contradict one another at all. It's that, well, chapter 2 is really looking at it from a different angle and looking how important Earth is, although we are a tiny little speck, aren't we, in the midst of these billions and billions of galaxies. Well, here we have it this morning then, the creation of mankind. And man is a special creature, a creation of God, and this is underlined for us in a number of different ways. Now, we're looking at the clock, and we've got to finish by 1:45, and we've got to sing a hymn by the end as well. So we've got a little bit of time, but an awful lot is going on here, isn't it? Let's break this down then into a few simple headings, that man is distinct, isn't he, in the mind and the will, in the purpose, if you've got, in the thinking of God. The way God himself thinks about us is very different to the way God thinks about everything else. So man is distinct in the mind and in the will and the purposes in the thinking of God himself. Now, there are, and we're going to be delving into this once we've gone through and looked at the simple language of chapter 1 and 2. We're going to go back a little bit and say, hang on a minute. In light of that theory and in light of that kind of teaching, in the light of what these modern men say, how can you reconcile them? And if they are irreconcilable, what should we really believe about the origins of the universe, the origins of life, the origins of the species, the origins of man? But what we've been doing over the last few weeks, and we'll carry on doing for the next couple of weeks or so, is just looking. How would the Jews and how would the church look at these chapters up until very relatively recently? For thousands of years, God's people have been studying these early chapters, and, well, it's only in the last 100 years, isn't it, that there has been an onslaught, hasn't there, from the scientific community and from the media and from various other sources that are militating against these early chapters. In these early chapters, we're seeing, aren't we, the origin of man. We're seeing the origin of marriage. We're seeing the origin of suffering and everything else. We're seeing the origin of all manner of things. Lists and lists of things have their beginning in these early chapters of Genesis. Well, the modern world, the Western world in which you and I live in, disagrees at just about every level. And it hasn't been until very recently, and many of us were praying about it, weren't we, last year or so, about the redefinition of marriage itself. Well, we're looking, aren't we, as if somewhat modern science didn't exist, and then we're going to go back and look at it over again. But this morning, we're looking at man. Why does the Bible, and in what way does the Bible say that we are distinct? We begin with the fact that in the mind and in the purposes, in the will and in the Word of God, man is distinct from everything else. We'll then look at how man is distinct in his very nature. We'll look then that man is distinct in his role, having dominion and authority over the world. We'll look at the way in which man is distinct because he's completely created in a totally different way to everything else. So it's not just the early chapters, but there are other places as well, but particularly as we focus on the early chapters, the Bible is screaming to us loud and clear, isn't it, that man is distinct. Now, you can turn around and say, well, if you were a goldfish, you would say the goldfish are distinct. No, if I was a goldfish, I wouldn't be thinking or talking in any way, shape or form. The fact that we can even say such a thing proves that we are distinct, doesn't it? Well, let's break these things down then. Distinct then in the divine mind and will of God. God says, let us make man in our image. Now, the word create here is used very sparingly in the first chapter, isn't it? In the beginning, verse 1, we had God created the heavens and the earth. And there you have matter, if you like, impersonal, unliving matter, the heavens and the earth. There is no life. There is no personality. It's just matter. And although God goes on and creates all manner and makes all manner and is doing all manner of things in that chapter as we've looked at, it isn't until you get to verse 21 that the word create is used again. So God created great sea creatures. So the word create is used very sparingly in the first chapter. In actual fact, only verse 1 and verse 21 until you get to the creation of man. And it's crying out, isn't it, that look, God created matter. The origin of matter, and not many of us, I know that one or two of us maybe, but not many of us have a degree in physics, and we don't really know what quantum physics is or theoretical physics, or, well, we looked at a number of other things, didn't we? We don't understand these things, but the Word of God is telling us that God made all these things. The laws of gravity, the atom, and everything else, and space, and time as we know it, and the black holes, and dark matter, and all these other things that are quite confusing and quite perplexing to me, that doesn't have a degree in any of the sciences. The Bible is saying, in simple language, God created the matter. And then when it comes to life, the origin of life, that word is used once again. God created life. Now, it's been quite recently that the scientists have been trying, haven't they, to create life. And they have failed absolutely miserably in creating life. In actual fact, if you ask the vast majority of biologists and scientists, what is life? They will bumble around and find it very difficult, in actual fact, to use language to really describe what life is. It's something quite mysterious, isn't it? But we are being told here in very simple, plain and clear language that God is the originator and the creator of matter, and God is the originator, designer and created of life. And we know now as we look down through our microscopes, and they're getting more and more powerful, aren't they? And we're looking at single living cells, and we're breaking them down, and we're breaking them down into atoms and quark and all manner of things. That highly complex, single living cell with all of its components was designed and created by God. But it's not until you get to verse 27 that God uses the word very unsparingly. Although it has only been used twice in the creation and making of all things up to day 6, in verse 27 the word is used 3 times in relation to man. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created him. Now we're looking at the first chapter of Genesis, aren't we, about the creation of all things. The word to make and create is used very sparingly up until this point, but as soon as you get to the creation of man, God uses the word 3 times and very unsparingly. And what does God say? Let us make man in our image. Up until that point, he's just saying, let there be, and there was, and he created and made. And so the language now is completely different, isn't it? It's as if God is stepping back, isn't it? And the writer here, Moses, under the inspiration of God, is, if you like, underlining and putting exclamation marks for us. That in the mind, in the will, in the purpose of God, man is distinct. God's approach to man's creation is with the weightiest of consideration, isn't it? The language itself is there for us. It's not that God has been blasé. It's not that all of the other things that are made are unimportant. It is very reverent. It is very awe-inspiring language, isn't it? Particularly in the original Hebrew. That all of the mysteries of time and space and matter and energy, design and everything else is bound up in those first 7 words in verse 1 of the Hebrew Bible. And then God says, light be, and light. It's awe-inspiring language, isn't it? But even the language itself, God steps back with the weightiest of consideration and says, let us. Now we read into that through the rest of the Bible, don't we, that it is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Let us make man in our image. So the use And the numbering of the times that the word created is used and the language itself shows us that man is distinct. There's these exclamation marks, if you like, that don't exist in the Hebrew language. There's this underlining. And so when the Hebrew writers wanted us to really see something very important and to stop and to really think about it and say, hey, that's more important and distinct from everything else, you really got to stop and consider this. The repetition of a word is used. And the fact that God had never said, Father, Son, and Spirit amongst themselves, let us make this in our image. Man is very distinct, isn't he, in the mind and the will of God. And we go on and we see that man is very distinct in his nature, isn't he? God never said about anything else, let us make it in our image and in our likeness. The phrase is unparalleled in the rest of God's creative acts. Everything else God formed was made after its kind, isn't it? And that's a very difficult word, and some people try to use the word species, after its species, if you like. And maybe that is one of the clearest words that we can use to translate and understand what God means when he says, let us make things according to their kind. But another way of looking at it is, God is saying, in their likeness. This is how God imagines, if you want. This is what God wants in the creating of the birds and in the various different types of birds and in the various different trees and seeds and plants and fruits and animals and everything else. Let us make it according to its kind. According to its species, if you like. But according to the image and the desire that God has for that thing. But when it comes to man, he doesn't say, let us make man according to its kind or his or her kind. The pattern, if you like, for man's nature and being is God himself. So he is distinct in nature. There's a radical differentiation, isn't there, from all other life forms. Man is not made according to his kind. There is no plan, there is no template, there's no example outside of God himself. It's not some likeness God has considered. Everything else has a likeness that God has considered, and it's going to be like that and according to kind of that kind of a thing, if you like. But when God comes to creating man, no, let us make him, let us make her, let us make them in our likeness. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? Well, it means that we are like God. The man on the street, the psychopath who is serving multiple life sentences, the drunkard and the atheist, is in the likeness of God. An illustration that I found quite helpful during the week is, imagine a lot of these castles that there are in Suffolk and in various other places that are just something of a ruin, if you like. There's not much more than the foundations and a few walls sticking up out of the ground. When you go and you look at those ruins and you ask, what was there? You don't say a warehouse or a cottage or a shed or a shop or a terraced house or anything else. You say, it's a castle. There was a castle there. There might not be much left of the castle, but nonetheless, when we look at the ruins of a castle, we know that it's not the ruins of anything else but a castle. That's mankind. We're going to get into chapter 3 and see how man has been distorted, if you like, and ruined. But nonetheless, man is created in the image of God. Well, how can we see this and how do we break that down then? If man is distinct in the will and in the mind and in the purposes of God, in the plan and in the way God has brought him about, if you like, a man is very distinct in his nature. How do we break that second point down, that man is distinct in his very nature? What elements of the image of God, if you like, remain in mankind? Even within the psychopath, the Hitler, if you like, The drunkard, even the atheist who denies the existence of God. What is there left within man so that we can know that we are created in his image? Well, the first one I'd say is knowledge. We have a conscience, don't we? A great deal has been lost in our conscience. Our conscience is defiled. Our conscience is fallen. Our conscience maybe is something like the ruin of a castle. But nonetheless, there is still a conscience there, isn't there? Man's intellect has been distorted, but nonetheless, there is intellect that is there. We're often mistaken about the matter of facts. We're certainly mistaken often about the origin of things, the purpose of life, and our destiny and everything else. We're certainly confused about who God is, but nonetheless, we have knowledge. Man is fallacious in his reasoning, if you like, but we are still rational beings. We are capable of investigation, of forensic science, if you like, of deliberation, of maintaining the rule of law. We can be competent scientists, brilliant reporters, worthy of credit, if you like, in the field of politics. You might just want to add, not many, but nonetheless, some are. The theory of relativity doesn't become invalid because Einstein wasn't a Bible-believing, card-carrying evangelical Christian. We know things. We know the rudiments of moral law, if you like. We know it's wrong to steal, it's wrong to betray, it's wrong to be greedy and covetous, it's wrong to lie, it's wrong to commit adultery. We know that it's right to love and to be honest, to be true and kind and generous. Even the Romans themselves, who were a perverse people, knew that their perversity was worthy of death. Paul writes this, doesn't he, in the book of Romans. When Paul is reasoning, if you like, when Paul is speaking to Felix, Felix doesn't scratch his head and say, Paul, I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. Now, if there were animals like dogs and cats or whatever around when Paul was reasoning with Felix, they didn't understand the language. They didn't comprehend anything that was going on. They had no sense of the divine. They had no sense of the moral. They could not reason these things. They had no knowledge of them whatsoever. But Felix knew, didn't he? He doesn't scratch his head and say, Paul, I have no idea what you're talking about when you are talking with me about righteousness, judgment to come, and self-control. Felix is not blasé. Felix trembles. He's created in the image of God like us all, and therefore he doesn't respond like the animals that were around. If there were any animals that were around, Felix trembles as Paul takes him through the Ten Commandments, talks to him about what is right and wrong, the just judgment that is to come, and therefore the need of every human being to show some self-control. Felix was a man who lacked self-control. Felix was a man that knew there was judgment to come, but didn't like thinking about it, certainly was not preparing himself for it. Felix was a man who knew the difference between right and wrong, was a moral being, and yet chose to ignore those truths and to suppress them within his heart. So when Paul reasons with him about righteousness, judgment to come, and self-control, he is not uncomprehending or blasé. Acts tells us he trembles. He knew that there was a God that made all things. He knew that we were somewhat created in the image of God, that we were rational beings and moral beings, and we have a knowledge of these things that the animal kingdom doesn't have. The animal kingdom has no knowledge of themselves and the divine. The animal kingdom has consciousness, if you like, but they are not conscious of being conscious. They cannot step outside of themselves and look at themselves in light of what is right and wrong, in light of the judgment to come, and in light of the presence and all-knowingness of Almighty God. We are distinct. The animals have never trembled at a discourse on righteousness, judgment, and self-control. But mankind does. We know that these things are true deep down inside. We can suppress them, we can ignore them, we can reject them and deny them, but we cannot deny that they exist. We are distinct. Not only in what God thinks of us, what God says of us, of what God's purposes are for us, although we are distinct in that way. We are distinct in our very nature because of the knowledge that we have of ourselves, of what is right, of God, of the eternal, and of judgment to come. We are distinct, second point under this heading, if you like, because of the freedom that we possess. Now, it may be a very small amount of freedom, a residual amount of freedom, a lingering freedom that is left, but nonetheless, we are free. Now, for those of us who know a lot about the Bible, you say, oh, well, man's will, aren't we in bondage to sin and everything else? But you choose to sin. Yes, in one sense now, because we're fallen, and we will get to that in chapter 3. We are free now only to choose what is evil and wrong and sinful. And when we do any seeming good, it is never by faith for the glory of God, a work that is commendable in the sight of God that he will reward us for. But nonetheless, we are free. In one sense, yes, we are slaves to sin, and we resolutely obey our master, sin, if you like, and we will get into that when we look at chapter 3 and the fall of mankind. But man freely submits to sin. He chooses to do so. We are not programmed to respond at the touch of a button. We are not computers or robots. We make our own decisions to have nothing to do with God. We are free agents, acting under no external compulsion, if you like, being forced to say no to Jesus. If we have been coming here for any length of time whatsoever, you've heard the gospel on multiple occasions at youth clubs or here or this, that and the other, and you say no again to Jesus this morning, there is nothing outside of yourself that is compelling you to say no. You freely reject God. You freely reject the truth. You freely reject Jesus. We can't say, oh, my life is mapped out for me by some remorseless factors in the environment, like the influence of parents or working conditions or companions or education or political leaders mapped out my society and my values. Although those things have something of an influence upon us, they do not force us to make the decisions that we make. We are accountable. We are responsible. Now, because we are rejecting that man is distinct, it's having all manner of consequences upon us as human beings, isn't it? So when somebody does something ferocious and horrendous, rather than treating them as a criminal who needs to be punished for a certain amount of time or in a certain way, and then treating him as somebody who has been punished and it's over and it's finished, it's dealt with, he must now move on and learn from it. We don't want to punish. We want to rehabilitate. We want to inject them with certain things, don't we? We want to brainwash them with certain courses, taking away the responsibility and the accountability and the fact that we must all answer before God. We are distinct in this way. The animals are not distinct in that way. They are not answerable to God. They are not free in that sense. They are somewhat programmed, if you like, to just live as animals. But we are not programmed. We are not limited in that sense. We are free to make moral decisions. We are created in the image of God. Man has a sense of the artistic and the creative, an aesthetic sense, if you like, technical terms. We are inventive and we are imaginative, we are innovative. There's a sense of beauty. We can create things that we appreciate, can't we? Whether it's art or music or sculpture or architecture or clothing or dancing or sport or various other things. We are created in the image of God with that ability. Have the animals ever taken up a paintbrush? Have the animals ever created a piece of music that is listened to by all other animals and appreciated? They may make noises. They may be able to sing, but they don't make music in the same sense that we do. They may make nests, but that's just according to their kind and what they need to survive, isn't it? But we make all manner of things, don't we? Because we're created in the image of God. Now, culture is not our religion, and to be something of a Philistine like myself, when it comes to cultural things, where I'm not particularly bothered by art, not particularly bothered by music, not particularly bothered by fashion and various other things, it's not the worst crime in the world. The worst crime in the world is to reject that we are distinctive creatures created in the image of God. The worst crime in the world is to reject Jesus, isn't it? But nonetheless, we are artistic people, artistic creatures. In the parables of Jesus, in the poetry of Isaiah and David, in the narratives of Luke, if you like, in the teaching of the Apostle Paul, there is a beauty that is the handmaid to truth. You may find beauty in many other forms of literature. You may find beauty in art. You may find beauty in this, that, and everything else. But everything else, if you like, outside of the glory of God is a worshipping of culture, a worshipping of the arts, a worshipping. And they don't care about the image or the message that it is portraying. But for God's people, we seek to be artistic, we seek to be creative, we seek to sing, we seek to engage in sports and in architecture and in drama and in various other things for the glory of God. And we are concerned about the image and the message that it portrays. But nonetheless, all human beings in all cultures throughout all of time have been expressive, creative, artistic creatures, unlike the animals. It's a distinction. You can't reconcile us. We can see also under this heading that we bear the image of God in our relationality. We relate one to another, don't we? We relate to one another, though, unlike the animals. You can say the animals have friends. You can have dogs that can be friends. And when one dog dies, the other dog severely mourns, if you like. But we have the ability to communicate, to relate to one another on a much higher plane. Yes, you can have David and Jonathan. Yes, you can have Paul and Barnabas, if you like. Yes, there are great friendships. There are even great marriages, aren't there, amongst unbelievers. Yes, there can be a deep, deep level of love and intimacy and communion and connection, even amongst unbelievers. But there is a level of relating, there is a level of communication and communing with one another that is far above that and far above anything that the animal kingdom could ever enjoy. Are we not coming into this place week after week to acknowledge the eternal, the uncreated, and the infinite God? Are we not here together to encourage one another, to build one another up, to strengthen one another, to hold one another accountable in light of the God we love, serve, and worship? There is a relationship there, isn't there? On a far higher plane than any unbeliever could ever have. That's why God has given us the church. We need relationships. God has said all the way through chapter 1, it was good, it was good, it was good. And God created Adam. It was good. He was good. But it's not good for man to be alone. Then he creates Eve and says it's very good. We can't live alone. We often, especially if you've got plenty of noisy children in the house, we love to get alone and spend some time on our own with a bit of peace and quiet maybe, or when the kids have gone to bed, sit and watch a bit of TV with your wife or something along those lines. But the relationship and the communion and the fellowship that we have predominantly as believers here this morning is on a completely different plane. He has set eternity in our hearts, hasn't he? There is a sense of the divine amongst us. A sense that we want to hear him, a sense that we want to worship him, a sense that we want to enjoy him, a sense that we want to glorify him, a sense that we want to help and encourage one another, walk and become more like the Lord Jesus Christ. The animals don't have that. And then on an even higher plane, there is communion with God. That we can be born again and we can have actual fellowship, a relationship, communion with God himself. We can know his love. We can know his peace. We can know his joy. We can know his will. We can know the blessed hope of his promises. But we can have fellowship and meet with God and not just enjoy what he says and what he gives, but can actually enjoy him for who he actually is. The animals don't have that ability. They can commune and fellowship and relate to one another on a purely material, on a purely bodily basis, if you like. But they can't commune with God and they can't commune one with another on a higher spiritual plane. We are completely distinct, aren't we? Not only in the mind and in the purposes, in the will, and because God says so, and that's what we are in God's eyes, but in our very nature, we are distinct. Third heading then for us this morning, these will be a little bit quicker, is we are distinct because of the dominion that we've been given. You notice in verse 26, let us make man in our image according to our likeness that we've just looked at as we bear the image of God in all of these ways. God communes with himself. God has knowledge of himself, doesn't he? We bear the image of God in these ways. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, we're told. And then in verse 28 to 30, then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. So God is saying to us here that man is his vice regent, if you like, that we have dominion, rule, authority, command, and power over the rest of creation. That doesn't mean that we can go around killing and shooting animals for fun, but it does mean that we can kill animals to eat. It doesn't mean that we can go around just chopping trees down because we feel like it, but we can chop trees down to keep us warm and to build our houses. And as God was sovereign over all that he made and is sovereign over man, now man enjoys something of that sovereignty over creation. And so it was for Adam to name all of the animals and the plants and everything else. And it was not for the animals to name themselves or to give Adam and Eve and their children names. It was the other way round. We're going to see in chapter 3 that in a sense, when we do sin against God and we do deny and rebel against his authority and his sovereignty, God in a sense says now that the creature will rebel against your authority and you will find out what it feels like. So when the animals attack us, when the weeds and everything grow up against us and ruin our crops, it's basically God saying, as you have rebelled against my sovereignty, now creation will rebel against your sovereignty. But in the beginning, that was not the case. And we still see the remnant of this, don't we? Dogs don't have humans for pets. Goldfish don't put us in swimming pools for their entertainment. It's the other way round, isn't it? And although maybe it may be difficult to get a great, huge, great big whale to jump through a hoop in something of a massive pool, nonetheless, we've managed it. It may be difficult for us to get a lion to sit down and take a snack and purr like a little cat, but nonetheless, we've accomplished and achieved it. It might be difficult to get the cobra to do something of a merry dance, but nonetheless, we've achieved and accomplished it, even in the fallen world. And it's not the other way around. Yes, maybe groups of animals have threatened us. Groups of animals maybe have even somewhat pushed us or hemmed us in, but we've never come under their dominion and control and sovereignty and their rule. We've always fought back, if you like, and subdued them. It's the history of the world, isn't it? The world in which we live in. God himself says, in my mind, in my heart, in my will, according to my thinking, you are distinct. You are distinct in your very nature. Just look within and at yourselves and look at the rule and the sovereignty, the power and authority that you have on the earth. Although it is somewhat broken, it is not completely removed. Although the earth and particularly the animal kingdom will rebel against you, you will still be able to harness ox and various other animals. So we're distinct, aren't we, in God's mind and will? We're distinct in nature. We're distinct in the dominion and the authority that we have over us. You can just look at our hands. We're completely different. As we are to point to various animals and to tell them what to do. As we're to communicate, if you like, and to use our hands to subdue, if you like, and to plant vineyards and everything else, we are distinct. There is no other creature that can take his other five fingers and point at his thumb. There is no other creature that can use his thumb and then go and point at the other fingers. We are completely unique. And when you look at the way we stand upright, when you look at the way our eyes focus forwards, when you look at the size of our enlarged brains and our reduced jaw and our weaker teeth that are fewer in number, when we look at the fact that we are hairless, when you look at the palate that is in a dome shape like a letter C, we are different. We can speak and communicate, and God is saying, you will stand upright. Your hip will be in a different place. You will look forward. Your hands will be able to do all manner of different things. Your tongue will be different so that you will have a highly complex language to express what is going on in your highly complex brains. You are distinct, and you are different. And lastly, as we close this morning, we're distinct in the procedures God adopts in forming and making us, aren't we? God makes us from the dust of the ground. For all the rest, he just seems to speak into existence, and according to his kind, he makes it. But when he comes to mankind, there is a completely different way in which he's created. He takes the dust, doesn't he, of the earth, and he makes us. He hadn't taken any pre-created elements or objects to create anything else whatsoever. He speaks them into existence and they come into being. But when it comes to man, God takes a very, very different route altogether, doesn't he? And the big one for us this morning, as we see in chapter 2 and verse 7, that God breathes into his nostrils and he becomes a living being. Different from the animals in the way we're created and made. It's almost as if God takes from the dust and he forms Adam and he comes and he embraces him and he kisses him, if you like, giving him the kiss of life, so to speak. Very different to all of the animals, isn't it? man was not alive until that moment. He was still an inanimate dust of the earth, if you like, until God breathed into him. God did not work on previously breathing stuff. Livingness came from God as he breathed into man. The fact was that he was not a man until God breathed into him. God could not talk to him. If there was life, if you like the animals, which I don't think there was, but if there was life, like in the animals, before God breathed into him, God would not communicate. God does not communicate with the animals, does he? He couldn't understand. He wouldn't be able to obey or love God until this breath was breathed into him. But as soon as God breathed into him, he became a living being. And he could hear God, and he could talk to God, and he could communicate with God. He could love God and receive God's love. He could obey and serve God. There's no hint here that for a long time there were other creatures similar to men alive, somewhat like mankind, and then God took one of these animals, if you like, breathed into them, and made him a man. God did not work on some pre-humanoids in a second stage of creation, making man out of some earlier creature. He took the dust, he formed a man, and he breathed into him. And this divine exhalation, if you like, alone can account for the nature and the being of mankind. You can't explain the extraordinary phenomenon of man without this piece of information and truth. The processes of evolution by forces and potencies resident in lower forms of life cannot account, my friends, for Galileo or Shakespeare, for Mozart or for Rembrandt, for Isaac Newton, for the Apostle Paul, and certainly cannot explain Jesus of Nazareth. Evolution could not bring about such a person. We will readily acknowledge that there is development within species, and we will look somewhat more at it at a later date. But two dogs taken from the ark can create lots of other dogs, or if there were other pairs of dogs, you could have loads of dogs maybe, or not an innumerable number, but you could have a few dogs and they go out into the world and create dogs. You could have a number of apes on the ark, if you like, and send them out into the world, and they will create different kinds of monkeys and apes. Man is distinct as God breathed into him and made him a living being. Man himself owes his unique knowledge that we've looked at, his freedom, his sense of beauty and ability to create, and his sense of community awareness, if you like, and his ability to think about God and to even commune with God through his Son, Jesus Christ, to the fact that God has made him in his image from the dust and he has breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Before that, we had not life. We were not living beings, and we were not what God says a human being is. Among the creatures, human nature, if you like, is the supreme and the most perfect revelation of God. How do you know God exists? Because there is time. How do you know God exists? Because there is space. How do you know that there is a God? Because there is matter. How do you know that there is God? Because the world is full of life. But the supremest revelation that God exists outside of his Son Jesus, well, is you right in front of me and me in front of you this morning. Romans tells us that God's not going to argue with you. He's not going to bully you. He's not going to intellectually argue with you so that you come to acknowledge his own existence. He says, you know very well that your image has been marred. You are fallen and sinful. You are not like you originally were in the garden. But in mercy, God has sent his Son, who is the exact image of God, whose image is marred more than any man at the cross, so that the image of God could be restored to us. You are created and made in the image of God. You cannot really inwardly, spiritually be like God without Jesus. But because Jesus is the perfect image of God, the exact representation of who God is sinless and perfect in every way, shape or form, and uniquely said, if you've sinned me, you've sinned the Father. He goes to the cross. He is beaten. He is battered beyond recognition. His image is marred more than any man, so that the image of God could be restored to us. We're all going to walk out of here in a few minutes' time. I do pray and hope that you will all walk out. You will all walk out upright, but I hope spiritually you will walk out upright. I am a creature created in the image of God. I'm not an animal walking out of this building. I'm a creature created in the image of God, and I can only be restored to that right image through Jesus Christ, who was battered, beaten, bruised beyond recognition at the cross. I do hope that that is the way that we walk out of here, each and every one of us, this morning. Amen. Let's close together then.